Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hi, how you doing? No, really, how are you? The economy wants to know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Greetings on a Friday. It's the 16th of September. Especially glad you could be with us today because, really, it's all about you, the humble American consumer. I'm not just saying that either. We learned today consumer sentiment is up just a tetch from where it was in August. And with all the pressure on consumers to help lead the economic recovery, even a slight gain is nice to see. What's not entirely clear, though, is how useful all those things that try to measure subjective sentiment really are. From New York, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Consumer sentiment data, the Consumer Confidence Index, the Consumer Comfort Index, all of these are supposed to help economists figure out how people like you and me are, well, feeling about the economy.
Feelings. Nothing more than feelings.
So how exactly do you measure feelings? Lynn Franco is an economist with the Conference Board, which issues a report on consumer confidence every month. She says to measure confidence, they ask 3,000 random people five questions.
What we ask them is to rate current business conditions and current employment conditions, and then we ask them their expectations 6 months out regarding business conditions, employment, and income prospects.
All the surveys are similar, but can a handful of multiple-choice questions really predict the future? Chris Christopher says yes. He's a senior economist at IHS Global Insight. He says the proof is that fuzzy feelings lead to pretty concrete actions.
Consumer sentiment fell over the summer months by 25%. Restaurant spending, clothing store spending, and department store spendings were very, very weak in August.
Christopher says consumer spending makes up about 70% of the U.S. economy. For people to start feeling better and spending again, companies have to start hiring again. Of course, for companies to start hiring, they have to feel like consumers will start spending again. Ugh, feelings. They're so messy. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Oh, Stacey. The big splashy hard economic news yesterday was that the Fed and the European Central Bank are going to team up to get more dollars into the European banking system. And that's great, because Lord knows they need the help. But why? Why do they need dollars? Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon follows the money.
One of the ways many big European banks make their money is lending abroad. And banking consultant Bert Ely says around the world, the color of the currency of choice is green.
The European banks in particular need dollars because many of their financial activities and specifically credit that they grant is granted in dollars rather than in euros. And so if they lend in dollars, they need to borrow in dollars.
And they've usually gotten those dollars through money market mutual funds here in the U.S. But those investors are now nervous about parking their money in Europe. So the U.S. Federal Reserve is teaming with its European counterpart to provide greenbacks to needy banks. Not to worry, says Ely, the European Central Bank will be doing the lending. It's swapping euros for dollars from the Fed and guaranteeing the Fed won't lose money.
These arrangements are done in such a way that there's no risk to taxpayers.
In fact, this program has existed since the 2008 financial crisis, only now the banks can borrow for longer than a week at a time, up to 3 months. Christopher Rupke is chief economist at Bank of Tokyo Mitsubishi in New York. He points out dollar lending in the past week has been far below the crisis levels of 3 years ago.
$500 billion was borrowed through these swap lines before, and now it's only $500 million. So we're nowhere even close to what the level of mistrust that we saw. It's kind of a confidence-building measure.
Confidence that European banks won't run short of cash and harm the global financial system and American companies doing business in Europe. Rupke says this buys some time, but it still doesn't solve Europe's underlying debt dilemma. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, pleasant enough. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Picking up where Mr. Moon left off, Europe and its debt is the story that keeps on giving, has been all week. So here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, way beyond today, we've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, John Carney from CNBC as well. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi.
All right, John. So on the theory that it's got to end sometime, how much time do we have left to find a fix to the European mess?
I think there's no fix. I think it's actually not going to end anytime soon. What we're going to have is resolutions of temporary things, either good or bad. Greece probably will go through an extreme moment. Whether that counts as a default or not, I don't know. But then we will have extreme moments in Italy and Portugal and Spain. We're going to have a cascade of these things happening over the next several months, well through 2012.
Extreme moments. I don't like the way that sounds. Is there more, Lee Gallagher, that the U.S. can do? I mean, Secretary Geithner's over there at the meeting of finance ministers in Poland. We had the swaps, as Bob Moon was just talking about. What else?
Well, I mean, I think Geithner being there is certainly helping. You know, the Fed is part of this joint central bank intervention, which is pretty rare and coordinated. But this really is a European problem. And, you know, we have our own problems. It's very similar to what we went through. I mean, Greece is kind of like a big, giant subprime borrower without a loan modification plan. Well, and, yeah, go ahead.
Well, so how does that not come back and bite us in the tuchus, John?
Well, it can.
it definitely can. We are lending out a ton of money. That money is supposedly backed by euros. But if you think about the mechanics of this, if the European Central Bank borrowed dollars from the Fed or any of these banks did, and they back them up with euros that they keep over in Europe, it's not really collectible. The idea that it is that there's no risk at all in these loans is a fiction. There is risk involved, although it's probably unlikely that we wouldn't get the money back.
Say that again. It's unlikely we would not. So we would eventually get it back, right?
We probably will get it back. But the central bankers talk as if there's no risk at all in these loans. If there was no risk, the market would be willing to lend the money. There is risk involved, and the central bankers don't want to talk about that because the whole point of this exercise is to try to tell people, you know, don't be afraid. They don't want to say, oh, guess what? We've now just also put U.S. taxpayers on the line for what's happening with banks that own a bunch of Greek debt.
Lee, do you think American taxpayers are really paying attention?
Well, I was just going to say we're not afraid. I mean, if you look at what's happening in the market this week, we've been up every day. Yeah. Europe feels very far away. Rogue trading over there feels very far away. Another big story this week. Yeah. And, you know, there hasn't even been talk of a double dip anymore here, which was sort of the big panic not so long ago. And I think, you know, that's because people equate the stock market with the economy and they're not at all one and the same. And we still have very big problems here. If you look at the news that came out this week, we have record 46 million people that are in the poverty line. And the poverty line is $22,000 for a family of four. So we have reasons to be concerned beyond just what's happening in Europe. I do think that our exposure to Europe is, I mean, it's we can't really feel a mortal wound here. I mean, I think Europe is going to feel the brunt of the pain.
All right. Well, let's talk about the week to come, John. The president's going to unveil his deficit reduction plan on Monday, yet he's still trying to get this jobs package through. Help me make sense of how this is going to work out.
The jobs package isn't going anywhere at all. Almost nothing will get done on that front. The deficit reduction plan, this is an advance of something of the super committee. There's just too many moving parts. I don't think any plan that's presented is going to go anywhere. Tim Geithner did say at a conference that CNBC hosted this week that he thought that what will eventually happen is something like the Simpson-Bowles proposal that mm-hmm. was, you know, that was ages ago at this point. And you think, why are we fighting all this time and getting back to something those guys proposed months and months and months ago?
That's the way Washington works, man. John Carney from CNBC, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks.
All right, have a good weekend. We've been trying to humanize the job market this week, hearing from people at various stages of life and how they feel about looking for a job in times like these. So far, we've had a 20-something, a just past 40-something, and we wrap up today with a woman in her 60s who's not near done yet.
My name is Kay Grabola, and I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. I'm in my 60s, and I left my job almost 4 years ago. I was the artistic director for a community arts center. When I first lost my job, my level of frustration was very high. I was forced out of a position that I really loved. And I wasted a certain amount of time, I think, just sort of tossing around, figuring out what my next step was. I am not out actively looking for a position anymore. And I think it's very hard for somebody in their 60s to be taken seriously as an applicant now. I have children in my 20s, and I think that we have to move aside for the younger generation. But there's an older segment of the working population that brings experience and a certain wisdom, and the younger generation brings a wonderful vitality. And you need both of those things to really have an optimum workforce.
We found Kay Grabola through our Public Insight Network. You can share your stories at publicinsightnetwork.org. Coming up.
I wouldn't throw arrows at Paul Simon. I think just the zeitgeist has changed a bit on that topic.
Selling songs or selling out? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 0.2% on this Friday. 75 points ended at 11,509. The NASDAQ up 0.5%, 15 points, finished at 2,622. The S&P 500 also put on about 0.5%, 6 points, closed at 1,216. For the week that was, the Dow rose 4.7%. The NASDAQ posted a 6.3% gain, the biggest weekly rise since July of 2009, should you be one of those who keeps track. The S&P 500 gained 5.4%. U.S. banks, though, had some indigestion as investors fret about the European debt crisis we were just talking about in the wrap. Bank of America left 1.3% on the table. J.P. Morgan Chase unloaded 1%. Prices on the 10-year T-note rose. The yield stood at 2.06%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In New York, the General Assembly of the United Nations holds a meeting to address prevention and control of non-communicable diseases such as cancer and diabetes. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. And happy birthday, Batman! Web sources say actor Adam West will be 83. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media is another way to say that. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a big push in higher education at the moment to get bigger, globally bigger, in fact. So to build their brands and, in the process, collect more tuition, American universities have opened branch campuses in Europe and China, the Middle East, and soon Rwanda. Carnegie Mellon University is going to start offering graduate engineering degrees in the capital city of Kigali. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
Rwanda is still recovering from the 1994 genocide, which left 800,000 people dead and the economy in ruins. It's staking its economic comeback on technology. The Rwandan government will foot the bill for the new Carnegie Mellon campus to help train the next generation of engineers and entrepreneurs. Pradeep Khosla is dean of engineering at Carnegie Mellon. He says the university's investment in dollars is zero.
But in terms of bringing its name, reputation, pedagogy, faculty, that's our contribution.
The first class of 40 or so students starts next year. They'll pay what students in Pittsburgh pay, roughly $38,000 a year. Khosla says financial aid will help cover that. Some efforts at international education have failed. Michigan State and George Mason have closed programs in the United Arab Emirates. But Carnegie Mellon isn't expecting its new campus to be a moneymaker.
You could look at establishing a presence in Africa as almost a form of philanthropy.
Ben Wildowski wrote The Great Brain Race about international education.
They're going to be helping a modest number of students in Rwanda, which certainly could use this kind of help. But at the same time, they're establishing that Carnegie Mellon is a global player that cares about the developing world.
Woldofsky says the challenge for the university will be to deliver the same quality it offers at home. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You've heard, perhaps, of the huge pile of trash floating out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's plastic, mostly, for thousands of miles, just bobbing along on the surface. There's a company that wants to recycle all that plastic and turn it into bottles, but it's not going to be easy. And that's kind of the point, as Adrian Hill reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Method, the company that makes high-end, environmentally friendly soaps and cleaners, has a plan, one that doesn't make much business sense and won't be an easy fix for cleaning up the oceans.
You're doing something highly impractical.
Adam Lowry is the co-founder at Method. The company wants to take ocean plastic and use it for new plastic bottles. Sounds good, except...
it's really low-quality material. It's been floating in the ocean for a decade or more.
And?
We need to clean it. There's a lot of dirt. There's a lot of biological material.
And?
It's not like a supply chain for ocean plastic exists.
And, seriously, there's more. Creating that ocean plastic supply chain isn't as easy as deploying big vacuum ships. Scripps Institution of Oceanography scientist Miriam Goldstein has studied the ocean garbage patch.
These pieces are very small and are spread out over a very large area.
She says about 90% of the plastic is less than the size of your pinky nail. It's like really gross confetti.
If you're going to collect them, it's going to be very hard to pick up these almost microscopic plastic pieces without picking up all of the microscopic animal life that's living on and amongst them.
But Method's Adam Lowry isn't deterred. He's going to get his plastic from groups already gathering it. He says the point is really to make a point that we ought to be recycling our plastic instead of tossing it out, which is also at the top of Goldstein's list of solutions.
Definitely number one is to stop putting plastic in the ocean to begin with.
Sounds straightforward, but she says we still have a long way to go. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Over the past 5 years, Sean Cole has done stories for us from Boston and London, Dubai and Toronto up north of the border. He is now moving on to do other things. So it's with a certain sense of nostalgia that we bring you this, his last story for us. It's about nostalgia, in fact, and the power it has to sell.
There's something wrong with me. I can vividly recall almost everything I saw on TV from, say, age 8 to 18. So I remember the night in 1987 when Paul Simon went on David Letterman and said he'd never license his music for advertising. In fact, he went as far as to say there would be no offer that would tempt me.
I actually really resent it. I think they've taken the music of my generation and all this music that I treasured so much, and they've associated it entirely with selling.
Yeah.
And I deeply resent it.
Slip, slide away.
Fast forward 23 years, I'm watching TV in my apartment in Toronto, and this commercial for snow tires comes on. Cars are careening out of control and smacking into each other on icy roads, accompanied by a Paul Simon song called
Slip, Slide Away.
On even the worst winter roads, Blizzak tires help keep you under control.
Now, I know it's just one ad, and I know that Paul Simon said what he said on TV more than 20 years ago. But yes, I honestly, naively thought he'd stand by those words forever. Plus, it's not just one ad.
Come on, fella.
There's also this Australian beer commercial.
I'm sitting in a railway station, got a ticket for my destination.
In both cases, of course, it's not Paul Simon singing. More recently, though, there was this Honda commercial in which Simon and Garfunkel are singing.
Presenting the One, the 34 mile per gallon Accord from Honda.
And after not too much obsessive digging, I found a press release from 2004 headlined Paul Simon Sign-In Music Publishing Deal. Turns out he'd been doing this for years, and now a company called United Music Publishing Group would handle all of his licensing outside North America. I put in an interview request with them, and while waiting to hear back, I called this guy.
My name is Terry O'Reilly. For a career, I'm an ad man.
Terry personally directs 500 commercials a year with his company Pirate Radio and Television in Toronto. And he also critiques the industry on a warts and all Canadian public radio show called The Age of Persuasion.
I wouldn't throw arrows at Paul Simon. I think just the zeitgeist has changed a bit on that topic.
Terry says he started to see this change around the time Reagan came into office. Somehow, he says, a Hollywood actor becoming a politician, it just changed the rules for what artistic celebrities were allowed to do.
It made it okay for actors to start doing commercial work. And it eventually, which is further ripples in the pond, made it okay for music writers to license their tracks. What he was really objecting to in that interview on Letterman was when they changed the lyric of a song.
The people from Midas Mufflers sent me a demo of their commercial. They wanted to use the Sound of Silence as the for their muffler. And they sent me their demo, you know. Yeah. You know.
How would that have sounded?
Hello, Midas, my old. Within the sound of Midas.
I mean, that I hate as an ad man.
Really?
Oh, hate it. I think it just cheapens the whole industry, gives us all a black eye. Where Paul Simon made his change, it'd be interesting to talk to him. So I hope you do get to talk to him to ask him that.
I did try. The publishing company sent my request to Paul Simon's management, who never got back to me. So when I heard he was doing an event at JFK Library in Boston, I sent a local reporter there, Anna Pinkert.
I've just walked through the door at the JFK Library, and I am waiting to speak with Paul Simon.
The event coordinator said she'd try to arrange something, but Simon didn't want to do it. So Anna settled for interviewing some fans in the lobby afterwards. A couple of them had no qualms about hearing Slip Sliding Away in a commercial.
Yeah, wouldn't you rather listen to that other schlock?
I'd much rather listen to music written by somebody good than to some trite jingle.
Others had plenty of qualms.
Some of his music is just from my growing up and my young adulthood, and I don't think it should go along with tires.
And you could argue that the latter point of view is unrealistic nowadays, but that's not true. It was unrealistic even back in 1987.
Artists are out to make money.
Again, Terry O'Reilly.
Artists, Paul Simon, love to create music and love to make money from their music. Everybody is a marketer. No, I don't mean in a bad way. I actually mean that in a good way. It's just a fact of life. They're out marketing their music.
And these days, landing your song in a commercial is just part of the business plan for a lot of artists. Artists are even singing about products these days. Wait a minute. Anyway, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note of a Friday, a moment to step away from the news of the week and hear a bit of what didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Noonan, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Jennifer Collins, reporter, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
So you've heard of these viral videos that show baseball fans demonstrating that a small and large cup of beer at their favorite stadium hold basically the same amount of beer.
I have, actually. It's kind of amazing.
So these intrepid reporters in Phoenix went down to their stadium to figure out that if you're ordering small beers, two small beers, you get 4 ounces more liquid, $1 less.
Than a large beer.
Right.
But let me ask you, has baseball become, like, less exciting or something? I mean, it just seems like fans are having more fun doing cost ratio analyses than watching the game.
Avishai Artsy, assistant producer of Marketplace, what's your story?
Microsoft has their newest version of Windows, Windows 8, and it's got a feature that a lot of people are talking about. It's an update to the blue screen of death.
Which is when your computer freezes and it just goes all blue.
Right, except now they've updated it, so you've got this frowny face emoticon, and then you have the words, your PC ran into a problem that it can't handle, and now it needs to restart.
That does sound a little nicer.
Yeah.
But, you know, if the buzz around your new product is that its failure screen is updated,
right,
I think your company might need to restart.
Jonathan Karp, senior editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
It's legal in Canada to surf the internet at work on the company's loonie.
Another reason to move to Canada.
Well, absolutely. Franklin Andrews, a government bureaucrat, was apparently spending more than half of his day surfing the internet. He was downloading lots of pornography.
Really?
But he got fired, and keep in mind, this is Canada, for time theft.
All right, but it didn't stick?
No, the court ruled that he had met all of his obligations. The government didn't give him enough work, so he wasn't stealing any time at all.
Hmm. May I ask, where did you find this story? The internet, perhaps? Are we not keeping you busy enough?
Talk to my boss about that.
There's more where that came from. It's a podcast Brendan and Rico do called The Dinner Party Download. The link is on our website. It's marketplace.org. One last thing before we go. Those who pay close attention to the production credits at the end of the show every day may have noticed something a bit different the past couple of Fridays. J.J. Yor has been the executive producer of this program, all the Marketplace programs, in fact, for 15 years. He was here when we went on the air almost 23 years ago, been here ever since. He's still here, his new title coming up in about a minute or so. But as we thought of a good way to mark his promotion, we went around the office the other day and asked Marketplacers the first thing they think of when they hear the name J.J. Yor.
Well, he walks really fast.
He walks really, really fast.
Yeah, he does walk fast. He's like the wind.
You know, sometimes I can hear him coming, but I never see him because he's so quick.
He always has like keys or something on him, so he jingles while he walks. So he's a fast walking jingler, is what he is.
And it's like, I think I see him, but I'm not sure. And when he does that, I think there should be sort of a whoosh sound.
I'll tell you, it was great, actually, because you always knew when you had to get back to work. Of course, that's shot now if he hears this, right? All right, that's Marketplace on a Friday from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 0.2%, about 75 points. The NASDAQ up 0.5%, 15 points. The S&P 500 also put on 0.5%, 6 points. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yor is now the vice president and general manager around these parts. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, a novel approach to traveling on a budget. Stay with total strangers.
So there was Justin, you know, shirtless in the window, and there I was. And we made eye contact, and I'm thinking to myself, is this the part where I'm supposed to go and say hello?
All righty then. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.